What up, folks? It's O'Shea Davis with the Working Wonder Podcast Show. And today I have a special guest, Steve Okapal. This podcast episode was long overdue after I seen him in Coach's T's Garage Talk back in 2020, I believe. He is a physics teacher, an intelligent human being, and in tune with the spirit as well. Steve Okapal, why don't you introduce yourself to our listeners?
As you said, my name is Steven Okapal. I'm a high school physics teacher. I grew up in a little town in Northwest Ohio called Findlay. I grew up in a very Catholic household, but a obviously Catholic household. Like, my mom grew up in a very Catholic household. My grandpa is a deacon. And there's always been church leaders on the family on that side as well. I mean, my parents were religious, but they were much more spiritually minded rather than make sure you're following every single letter of the religious code and everything for that. So that was a big influence on me. I had a fairly decent childhood growing up. Like, I dealt with some pretty rough abuse from my older brother in the 80s. And that did a lot of forming of, like, the way that I relate to suffering and other people. But because of that, I was able to form really strong friendships with a few people. And my own perspective on coming from a very, very conservative town that, like, I knew right away, like, okay, this is not reality at all. This is not the way that people live. And I'm not sure if it's 100% true or not, but when I was growing up, there was a story that, like, they were pulling the city lines back every year so that they'd never have a population of more than 50,000 people in the actual city itself. Oh, wow. Yeah, that stopped in the, like, 2000, because after the Patriot Act and everything, it was kind of messed up. But, like,
what city was this again?
Findlay, F-I-N-D-L-A-Y. It was the world headquarters for Marathon Oil. It's now the national headquarters. And
this is in Oklahoma, correct?
This is in Ohio.
Oh, Ohio.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, Northwest Ohio, where I grew up. Yeah. And I went there, and it was fine. I went to Catholic school, again, very, very sheltered, but I read a lot and was always thinking about different things. Went to a public high school, and that was a little bit more open-minded, but it was still very much like, it was a very small, isolated community. And when I tell people that, when I'm like, about 10% of the population was Latino, and I could count the number of black people in my high school on one hand, like, it was not racially diverse at all where I was coming from. That being said, my parents were activists back in the 60s, so they were very interested in, like, continuing that on with me. So when I was about 15 or so, I started my first actual, like, participation in protest events, specifically labor union marches in the 90s. Part of that was an offshoot of the Catholic Church, because Bishop Gumbleton out of Detroit was very active in trying to, like, revitalize that community and just build up people as much as possible. And they did that a lot through labor union stuff. Also, again, like I said, my grandpa was a deacon. So his influence was very much like, look at the context of what's happening. We would go and have, like, family church once every month or so. And then afterwards, we'd have, like, the whole dinner get together on my mom's side. So we'd go to church. And to keep me out of the hair of everybody, because I was always running my mouth too much, my grandpa would always sit me down and be like, all right, so this is what we read. Now, this is the page that happened beforehand. This is the page that happened afterwards. So what do you think the actual context is for that whole story, right? And so that, number one, influenced the way I looked at spirituality, because if you're just looking at what people are doing right now, as just isolated, like, this is what we're doing today, you're neglecting their whole story from behind. It also neglects what they're looking forward to. And anybody who thinks spirituality happens in a vacuum just has not been paying attention and needs to do a lot more research and live through some of this stuff. It also had a huge influence on me in terms of, like, studying science and philosophy outside of that, because learning the context of what it is that you're going to be getting into is, number one, way better for if you're actually building understanding over knowledge.
Absolutely.
Like, I could have, like, spit back all kinds of facts about planets and moons when I was, like, 8 or 9 getting really into astronomy.
Yeah.
But that's never going to get you to learn, like, how does a planet form and what, like, is the cycle of a star? Like, those are way bigger concepts that you have to have, like, understanding for, which means you got to have the context. Yes, sir. So then in high school, like I said, I had a real tight-knit group of friends that we would hang out together. One of my best friends, 3 weeks younger than me, spent our entire lives growing up. We had a split because, like, after school, it was just like, well, I'm going to college. Like, there was no question I was going to college. I thought I was going to be a pharmaceutical major because I was really into chemistry. Mm-hmm. And he ended up taking a year off, traveling to Europe, and then coming back. We actually ended up being roommates for a couple of years in college because I went to get degrees in physics and philosophy while he went to get an English education degree. So now he's an English teacher back in Ohio, and I'm a physics teacher out in Oklahoma. So it was a little bit of a weird thing there.
What college did you go to?
I went to Ohio State University. I'm sorry, the Ohio State the University, because they always want to throw that in.
Yes, they do.
And I went at a really weird time because it was right, like, I started in 98. So I got in and I got to see what college used to be like. Then throughout 2001 to 2004, the deregulation of the student loan market destroyed the entire concept of what school used to be. Like, I watched school go from, I think it cost something like $5,000 my first year, and that was for all of my tuition. Wow. To by the time I graduated in 2005, it was like almost $6,000 each quarter when I was going. And like, and I just, and part of that is because my dad is an IRS guy, or was until he retired. So like, financial stuff is always just swimming in the back of my brain. I always know numbers and math, and just like, I knew when it first started, I was like, oh crap, I have to like get out of school because otherwise I'm going to end up with like as much debt as my brother who got his PhD, but without any way to pay it off. So I, after that, I started to figure out what I wanted to do. Basically, I stopped just using college as a place to like meet people. I'd play in bands and stuff. And I was pretty serious about my studies, but it was compartmentalized. Mm-hmm. So I was also real into like enjoying my life in my early 20s, as you do. And then after that, I spent a year after college, worked in a pizza shop, ran some different jobs, started teaching at a community college out in Ohio, and just decided that while I was looking around at what I should do, I was looking at Oklahoma because I figured I can teach science. My other options that were out there, I was just like, I really couldn't do that. Like, Bank of America tried to get me to become an investment banker. And when I looked at what that was, I was just like, I can't do any of that. Because this was 2005, 2006. So it was really, really nasty and just cutthroat and the sort of thing that, like, I couldn't be in that environment.
Oh, yeah, I can only imagine that, yeah.
Yeah. But then I had family out here. I got an aunt and uncle and some cousins. They let me live with them. I started teaching at TCC in 2006, fall of 2006. Doing that, tutoring in the math lab and teaching math classes up through everything, up through calculus. I met a lady named Linda Stromblad, who was the head of the math, what is it? It's, I don't remember what it's called. I think, oh, it's the math lab. That's what it was.
Okay.
Yeah.
Head of the math lab.
Right. Like, she was the director of the math lab, but she had also helped start the school, Tulsa School of Arts and Sciences, that I had never heard of. But she said, hey, you've got a degree in physics. They're looking for a physics teacher. Why don't you go interview?
Yeah.
And at the interview, they asked me, like, okay, so if you could teach one elective to high school students, what would it be? And I was just like, well, I got a degree in philosophy. I'd love to be able to do something with that.
Oh, yeah.
And at the interview, they were just like, that sounds great. We could do that. And a week later, they were like, nobody else interviewed that was qualified. So the job's yours if you want it. That was in like July of 2007. And I'm still there 16 years later because I just love what I've been doing that with.
I can connect with you on the idea of teaching because I realize that as you're connecting with students, you're bringing out their higher self. Does that make sense? You're allowing them to see that what's on the surface is not always what it looks like, kind of like what you said with your grandfather.
Right.
And looking in between. And I'm not a person that's very good at math or physics or any of those subjects. A lot of people aren't. However, I think a lot of it is about how you think about the numbers. because numbers are not very tangible, right? So using our imagination to be able to fathom whatever the equation is, and because I believe I'm a little more creative-minded, teachers who can tap into that with their students really get my attention. Right. And it's such a subject that because it's can be complicated, you have to be creative. Mm-hmm. And I can tell already, you being a musician and playing in bands, you're a creative individual.
I try to be.
And I'm imagining your students often like you.
Yeah. Even, I mean, I got... So we just finished off our second trimester, and that means that, like, because of the way the school's set up, that means some kids are done with their 10th grade physics. Like, they do it for 6 months at, like, over an hour a day instead of doing it for, like, 45 minutes all year long. And I've always just have at least, like, 5 to 10 of the students going, you know what? I hate this class. It's way too hard, but I like you as a teacher. And... that's just one of those things where it's just, I'm used to that. Cause yeah, I mean, physics is hard. If it was easy, there'd be a lot more people in STEM careers. And what most people just have to understand though, is like, it's all about how do you interact with the world around you, right? Like 90% of good physics has very little to do with math in terms of like an everyday sort of thing. Yeah, it's just there's stuff coming at me fast, I should get out of the way. Or is there something coming at me slow, I don't have to worry about it so much, right? Or like, how much is this going to cost in terms of like, how much gas is it going to take me to get from one place to another? Most of the math that people are going to use on their daily basis, it's not much beyond algebra and geometry. And if you can get to understanding what the concepts are and just reaching people with the skills that they've got, you can have a huge effect on how they actually learn about the world around them and then also help them to become better critical thinkers. Because if anything, that's the key part to understanding science, is you've got to be able to step outside of, well, this is what I think it should be, and you got to be able to look at things as they are.
I like that. I like that a lot, because I realized just from reading and studying that every idea you've read in a book is somebody else's theory. Not necessarily always 100% factual, but there's a level of it. They experimented with it and they created this hypothesis. However, as they continue to research it and as we continue to discover new ideas, we've realized that the other ideas are a little outdated. And that's just a natural evolution of knowledge and information. And I think that's creative that you even say that when it comes to your students. They'll say, I like you, which means you're doing a good job, but the subject is hard. And I also think it's, what I mean by creative is the fact that you said the actual applicability of physics, the actual applicability of math. I think that's how you draw people in. I took a course just maybe a year ago, and it was quantitative reasoning. And it was the only course I've ever taken that was actually related to what I do as an adult. I mean, it was teaching me things such as how interest compounds on a credit card and what to look for when you're buying cars. And I'm like, why did I learn this in high school? I would have been better off today. However, for those who have the interest in higher level of knowledge, meaning higher levels of physics and maths, they love that stuff, right? They love the theories. They love it. And every time I teach CPR classes, I tell people, this is what the textbook says, and this is real life. Because there's two different ideas. And the academic world, as you probably know from reading and researching, every now and then feels somewhat disconnected from the actual application.
Oh, yeah. Especially, like, I mean, less in the physics and more in philosophy, because in general, when you're looking at the, like, far reaches of physics, unless you're talking about astrophysics or quantum physics, most of it is very, very tangible and very much about, like, what can we actually do with this sort of stuff. But one of the things you were talking about, and what I like to go back to, is one of the lessons that I always go with my students is about how past theories have failed, but that doesn't mean that they were a failure as a theory. One of the big ones is about what's this thing called the caloric theory. And we had this idea that whenever heat transferred, there was this invisible massless fluid that was going from one place to another. They got this idea because they like look at fires and you look above it and like, oh, there's this wavy fluid going off of it. And that was part of the inspiration. And then when they go mathematically, like figure it out, they knew about temperatures. And so they could go through and figure out like the mass of an object and the temperature dispersion. And it worked, right? The caloric theory for what it was doing worked for a while. Because if you're just dealing with, I want to heat up this pot of water, how much wood do I need to make it happen? That works. But it also came up with this idea of conservation of caloric. Fast forward 25, 50 years, and somebody starts to think about things in terms of energy and kinetic energy. And somebody comes along and goes, oh my God, it's not caloric that's conserved, it's energy that's conserved. And that was in like the 1800s. That transition from a failed theory that postulated something that didn't exist at all, but mathematically worked out, brought us to an insight that literally changed the world. Because once we understood conservation of energy and the way that it could transform, that opened up the Industrial Revolution. Mm-hmm. That, along with a couple other ingredients, is like what made that happen. So by standing on a failed theory that had some good parts to it, understanding what needed to be kept and what needed to be pushed away, we were able to refine something into a better theory that then had a huge impact on the world around us. And that's part of what I like to do as a teacher, because like I know these kids are bringing stuff with them. And they know things like, oh, I'm riding on my bike and I hit the like a rock on just one side of my wheel. It starts to go off and I fall off over this way. They don't necessarily understand, yeah, that's because there's this normal force that you're hitting. You're getting a reaction force. Newton's third law is in motion here. Your momentum starts to go off in this other direction and you crash into something. I can take what they've already got and go into and dig into this is how it all works. The biggest part about that, though, and this is my key to every single teacher out there, is you got to have time for the students' questions. Biggest difference between my class and most others is that there's always that time in every single class, every single lecture, every demo, basically everything except for test day, where there's 5 to 10 minutes worth of class of just ask me questions. When you've got one, interrupt me. The worst thing you're going to hear from me is say, write that down. 2 minutes, we'll get to a point where we can answer that. But that's the worst that my students are going to get from me. And a lot of other teachers I know, not as much at my school, but I hear horror stories from all around. They're just like, students ask questions and their first reaction is, I don't know, it's in the book. I don't know, look it up yourself. And I'm just like, you've got such an opportunity right there to like not only encourage and influence that person to know how to ask questions, but then you've also got the ability to actually like build a rapport and a relationship with them where they will trust you, which then leads to them actually listening to you more. Exactly. And that feedback of it all, being in that moment and being able to encourage that, if you don't look at education as a spiritual endeavor, then you might miss that. And if you do look at education as a spiritual endeavor, you're never gonna miss that.
I love that, man. That's powerful stuff. Man, I love what you just said. You said if you see teaching or education as a spiritual endeavor, that you'll never miss that the most important part is to connect with that human being. Coming back to it, if a person doesn't understand, you give them the option to understand. And if you don't try to educate yourself enough from just relying on the book, how dependable are you really as a resource? Because at that moment, do we even need you here? Right? So I think it's important for teachers to understand they have to spend time reading about their subject, internalizing the information, and then being able to teach it outside of just how the book teaches it. Because that way, when they're asked a question about something they do not understand, and they read the book, and they still don't understand, well, you have to be able to elaborate and explain it to that child or that student. And going back to that, too, is that it's not about the teacher. It's about the student. Right. And it goes back to spirituality. When you take the idea of individualism, take it away and think about it collectivism, right? Collectively, how are we going to understand problems in our society, or how are we together going to understand even the math equation, whatever it is? It's not about the individual. It's about us as a whole. So once you separate yourself, the ego, the I from it, then we can understand more about we.
Right. And I couldn't have put some of that better myself. The only thing that I would like add to that is the one side of it that, first clarifying, I never expect the students to understand everything I'm saying. I expect them to understand like the main points. Mm-hmm. And then after that, it's a matter of, okay, great, awesome. Now that we got this foundation, I got a million pieces of spaghetti I'm going to throw at the wall. One or two of them are going to stick with you. One or two are going to stick with this person over here. But the key part is then, once you've got that first core thing, where do you build your interest from? Yes. And you're talking about keeping up with reading and everything. One of my big favorite things to do is to keep up with what is modern science doing. Mm-hmm. And there's this website that's great. It's called Science Daily. They've been around since, I want to say, like the early 2000s. And it's just a repository for modern research white papers. And it's everything scientific, and it's all just 2 to 3 page summations of it. So it's not here's 80 pages worth of data and 20 pages talking about it. It's here's the like intro and conclusion put together, and here's the reference for all the links so you can get all that stuff.
I like that.
Great, because like, especially in my astronomy class, we get to go then look at things. How did they put together that picture of that black hole? One of my favorite things in the last few years is we watched two black holes collide and they sent out a gravitational wave. And they figured out that they sent out a gravitational wave, literally shooting this laser at this piece of reflective material. And the reflective material vibrated 1/1,000,000,000th of a meter, like this tiny, tiny little amount that you wouldn't have been able to tell except one of the wavelengths of the light that was going at it didn't hit right. And so because that one wavelength of light didn't hit right, they were able to say, oh yeah, so that's a gravitational wave coming from out of here. It's one thing for me to say that. It's another thing to then be able to take the kids and say like, now, tomorrow, we're going to read that article together and you're going to see how it is I got all that information from this article. And being able to teach that side of scientific literacy, number one, means that after they're out of my class, they go on and do that on their own. Number two, it means that they can start asking me then questions about, okay, well, what about magnetic fields or supernovas? Or they want to look into like how we're using computers to like connect with people's brains directly. And they want to, so how does all that stuff work? And I'm just like, 90% of the time, I don't know, but I know where to look. Most of them are going to learn a lot more than I can actually teach them. What I really need to do is be giving them the tools to be able to think. That step is what really breaks that whole like, well, it's all about me and how smart I am. I know I'm smart, right? Like, I don't need to have a million different people knowing everything I do just to know that I'm smart. What's really important for me is, can I help these kids so that like 4 years out of school, they're still smart? Yes. And if you can get to that point, then that's what I'm here for.
I like how you said that they're still smart. What I believe that a lot of people have the mistaken identity that intelligence is fixed. Right. And it's not. You're ever evolving and learning. Even if you're not good at something, you can get better. Okay. It's just a matter if you really want to get better and if you're trying to get better. Some people get better at things a little bit faster than others. But with intentionality and actual strategies like you're doing, you're teaching these kids how to strategize learning. Right. And I think a lot of kids are not taught how to learn.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah.
Like, so I've read a lot of books, and actually on this podcast, I mentioned books about memory and learning and acquiring information. And as I teach my CPR first aid classes, every now and then I throw out questions from things I said earlier in the lecture or in the class. And then I notice people who are paying attention, that's really focusing on information, will shout those numbers back and those ideas back. Then I start thinking, I said, I'm going to start at these same people that keep saying the right answers. I'll point at them and make a joke. I'm like, you're an A student, aren't you? And a lot of them say, yes, I am. I am an A student. And I realize it's because it's not necessarily that a kid is smarter than the other, but it's their ability to focus, to pay attention, and then take that information and then associate it with something relative to what they just heard.
That makes so much sense, and that's a perfect segue into the next thing that I wanted to talk about. Because one of the things I've been doing this year, right? Last year, our school didn't have Wednesdays. We just do Monday, Tuesday, then Thursday, Friday school. And the first part of the year, or the ending of 2020, 2021, we were just doing like some students on Monday, Thursday, some on Tuesday, Friday. And last year, it was all year, 4 days, just Wednesdays were off. And it was so like, the reasoning behind it was then you'd have a buffer, right? That like if you started to feel sick on Wednesday, you would have infected less people. And it actually worked out really, really well. We had pretty low cases at my school.
Yeah.
But coming back, right, I rearranged my entire curriculum to make that space for that day every week to where I'd just be like, well, the students are just supposed to be working on homework that day. This year, because of my own like journey into meditation and other types of things, I started doing a mindfulness program with my students, with my 10th graders.
I like that.
So with my core class now on Wednesdays, we have about a 20 to 30 minute long class where I introduce a topic or some sort of technique with mindfulness. We'll go through a practice with that. And then the rest of the week, the first 5 to 10 minutes of class, we'll go back to whatever practice that was that we had for that week. And the first thing it does is it breaks their like weird, bizarre connection to all the drama and crap going on in their lives. Well, we already instituted the whole no phones out thing. We've got Yonder pouches and it's been working for some of them, but it's one of those things where it's like it's a 5-year plan to get it all in there. And we've still got like some 11th and 12th graders that are just like, I'm not going to use the pouch. The reality is they don't get their phones out because they know that if it's not in the pouch, we take it. We go down to the dean of students. She gives them another pouch and goes, now you got a $25 bill because you don't have the other one and all this other things behind it. Not having the phones is huge. The mindfulness breaks their whole like worry, just the train of thought of just I'm in constant anxiety, which with like a lot of students, it's really helpful. But it also gives them techniques to use like outside of class. And I didn't have a lot of them doing it this time, but and it wasn't a huge thing, but it, you know, shook up a bunch of people. And by using these techniques, I was able to calm myself down. But what they were more saying and more reporting than anything else was just the fact that it was easier for them to focus after they went through this like 5-10 minutes of just, all right, I'm going to clear out everything. I'm just going to focus on what I'm doing, which is breathing and being. That idea, that ability to focus on a single thing. Number one, it's not what the message they're getting from all the rest of society, because all the rest of society is always saying, do as much as you can, as many times as you can, even though we know multitasking isn't real.
No, it's not.
Like, it's totally not real. Gosh. And it's one of those weird things because my brain actually does a weird thing, and I'll talk more about this in a little bit, to where I can pay attention to multiple things at once. It's limited into, like, what I'm able to pay attention to.
Yes.
And if I'm trying to do 2 math problems at once, my brain's broken. It's like if I'm trying to pay attention to 2 different types of music at once,
yeah,
it's not happening. I can do math and listen to music at the same time. I can think about math and music while I'm thinking about other things. Once I try to do 2 of the same thing at once, that's when it just breaks down. And that's the problem with multitasking, is that you're doing the same thing. You can switch back and forth better than most people. You're still not as good as one person just focusing on this thing. And what I found this year was that like my failure rate, once you take out the students that had 10 or more days out, I only had like 2 or 3 students actually fail my class this year. And I had more A's and B's than I've had in any other class. And it was mostly, I think the biggest correlation is the fact that they're focused more in class. They did more work in class, so they didn't have to worry about it outside. So
yeah,
they always had their homework. It might not be totally done, but it's 50 to 75% done, and that's way better than a 0 every single day, especially in science, right? Because the point is not perfection. There is no perfect in science. It's just getting incrementally closer to something that's better. And that improvement, that constant idea of there is no end of this. There is no final point where we just go, yep, we understand it all. It's always looking at how do we make this better and getting that focus in.
I love this conversation.
Oh, yeah.
I love it. I knew it was meant to be whenever I watched you on that, like I said, with Coach T. I was like, I got to meet this guy. It's happening. Going back to that, what you said is that singular focus, the ability to just look at that one problem and actually disconnect initially from the world and then go into the problem.
Yep.
It's something about that that frees the mind and allows it its ability to think. There's something that I was watching, I believe it was on Instagram. You ever heard of Dr. Huberman? You haven't? Okay. He talked about this deal, I think it was called like micro rest, meaning when a person's working on a problem, if they take 10 seconds, 15 seconds away from the problem, breathe, a couple breaths, come back, or just completely disconnect for a minute or two and come back. If something special happens with the mind. The mind is so obsessed with focusing on something that the pressure's on, right? And then you alleviate that pressure, drink of water, use the bathroom, come back, and it's like a clear sight or a clear screen. Now we get to look at it in a different angle. And I think that that's what's unique about you doing this and practicing mindfulness with your students, because that's a skill they can utilize for the rest of their life. And little do they know, life is not going to get easy. It gets harder. You have to become more disciplined mentally, more disciplined emotionally, and even more disciplined physically all the way around. So you're teaching them this little bit of mental focus and discipline that I hope these students realized that that is
was
very
at
special.
At the show, I was just like starting talking. Just like, man, life was way harder after high school. I'm like, yeah, no kidding.
Yeah.
Like the real world is a lot more difficult than when you've got people who, like, number one, care what you have to say. Because that's one thing that in reality, most people don't care what you have to say.
No.
Number two, you've got people that are actually like, when you screw up, they want to work with you to get better at it. And the rest of the world, it's just like, yeah, okay, you screwed up. And now we're going to move on. So what?
In other people's workplaces or places I've worked for in the past, instead of encouraging you and pulling you up, it's like they laugh at you for failing, make fun of you for failing, and not realizing that that failure is on them because they see that you're failing, but they're not trying to help you. So that goes back to a topic I speak a lot about in my podcast, and that's leadership. It's really understanding that as a teacher, you're a leader. As a parent, you're a leader. As a sibling, you're a leader. So you're leading this person and encouraging this person to become the best version of themselves. And if you're not trying to get them to that point, you should question whether or not you're a true caring human being.
Right. Yeah. And whether or not you're fit for leadership. One of the things I had to deal with my second year was an incident with a student that was just completely out of anywhere close to like acceptable like behavior whatsoever, right? And a lot of it just had to do with the fact that like I wasn't addressing the problems the student was bringing in. I was just trying to move them away from their other friends that were bothering them and doing all the like teacher stuff, like moving them out to the hallway and that sort of thing. When they came back to class, it never addressed what the problem was. It got to the point where like they're just like yelling out crazy stuff in the middle of class. It took me a while to figure out like, okay, what I need to do is not stick him in the back of class or let him like run off. What I need to do with this student is keep him right up at the front with me and make sure that they're actually engaged with what's going on. And after that, it wasn't the greatest. There was no turnaround. Like the kid didn't become an A student, but the classroom became a lot more peaceful. A bunch of other people were able to actually do their work. And this student actually got some things done and was able to pass my course, which was not something that they were going to do beforehand. But it took me understanding, no, you've been doing this wrong and you've got to do something better. That more than anything, because I mean, I've been through in 16 years, everything I learned about teaching when I first went into it is almost completely worthless, right? Like when I first started teaching, the big focus was how do we get more women involved in education and specifically science education? Because in the STEM fields in the 2000s, when you looked at things, it's like, yeah, racially there was some disparity, but there wasn't like a huge disparity. It was like, yeah, there's more white people and more Asian people, blacks and Latinos, but it's not like it was unheard of. You know, there's an 8% of the population is black, and so but only 1% were scientists. It was something more like 4 or 5%, right? Mm-hmm. The big disparity was science was like 85, 90% male at the time. And that was a big, huge thing about outreach. Has seen a lot of success in the last 15 years, and that's really not where the focus is anymore when it comes to how do you get to different outreach with different communities. So I came into teaching, the first thing I have to do is make sure girls' voices are heard in my classroom, because that's the first barrier to science is they're just dismissed or never asked, like, what do they think? And so I was always focused on, okay, how do we get this to come through? That changed, and then after a while, a lot of it had to do with like, okay, so now how do we deal with like trans students? Our population at our school changed. They had a lot more transgender students coming through, and I had to adjust. How do I wrap myself around this? Because that's not something that I ever really understood. I had gay friends growing up in the 90s, but there weren't really many trans people around. A 15-year-old in my class, I don't know how to like deal with you. You just deal with them like you do every other person. And that was, you know, that was really helpful. In the last like 4 to 5 years, our school completely moved. Our demographics have totally changed through a lot of very specific and intentional outreach from a lot of our administration. And so now we've got a really racially diverse school. My own background, I'm more comfortable with Latinx people only because that's who I grew up with. You go into a Catholic church, you see Latinos all over the place, right? Like it's just, it's gonna happen. So that was never an issue with me. But dealing with black students and Asian students, I just didn't have that grounding of comfortability, navigating how do you talk with them and everything. And again, the answer just came down to you treat them like a human being and listen to what it is that they gotta say. And if you do that, then all the other crap falls away. But it's the key part of looking at a human being as a human being and not seeing all of the other stuff people put in front of them, which I just want to say right off the bat right now, there's still a lot of work to do, but I'm trying to do what I can.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, I agree with you for sure, is that if we just look at each other just being humans on this earth rather than trying to judge or draw stereotypes over people for whatever reason, it's like we get frustrated because of the things we don't understand. But at the same time, their existence itself, is it really bothering us? Is it really impacting our lives directly? And I would say that most of the time what other people do and who they are doesn't really directly impact. But how you interact with them and how you treat them makes a difference in your life, their life, the people who's watching you and their children watching them, and you name it. The character has to be way more powerful than any other barrier, boundary, sexuality, orientation, race, you name it. Your character is going to tell you your true color. And I think that's the definition of, if we look at each other and we examine each other's character, we're trying to evolve each other's character and intimately and even spiritually understand that, we're going to always grow as a human race.
That's one of the cornerstones when I teach ethics in my philosophy elective. And when we get into ethics, that's my first thing, is like, ethics is all about the philosophy of human interaction. It's not always direct human interaction. Sometimes it's like animal to human interaction. Sometimes it's human to environmental interaction. Sometimes it's human to societal interactions. But it always comes down to, what is the individual bringing to this, and how are they individually acting in the most ethical manner that they can? Listen, find out what their story is, and you'll probably be able to learn something.
I saw this quote, or I should say, I listened to something that Oprah Winfrey said, and I thought it was very powerful. She said that whenever someone had problematic behavior, or they had something that you question, you know, why they are the way they are, or who they are, she said she would say, I wonder what happened to them. I wonder what occurred, what transpired for them to react this way. Because it's so funny, because we'll see a reaction, like even on YouTube, Instagram, of someone acting belligerent. Right. And you're like, okay, but what's the backstory here, right? Like, what led to it? And if we can see the backstory, we may have a better understanding. It doesn't justify their reaction or their actions, but what it does do is gives us a better outlook. It's almost like whenever we have someone we're really close to, and they're telling us a story, and we trust them. So everything that they say, we take it for face value. But I was always taught, even from the ones we love, my mom always says this. She said, there's three sides to every story: his, hers, and the truth. Somewhere in between is their idea of what they experience and their idea of what they experience, and it both contains truth. Right. But the centerpiece is how those two truths collided. And in between that, we can detect what is real and what is an emotional experience. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense? Not that these emotional experiences isn't real. It is real. But there is something that we interpret when we see things happen that we go, one person can say, oh my gosh, that made me feel so bad. The person is like, oh dang, well, right? And then you ask yourself, does this person care, or is this person maybe used to that type of environment? For example, being a firefighter, we see stuff, yeah, right? We see chaotic stuff. So when chaos is amidst us, sometimes outside of our workplace, for us, it feels kind of normal, mm-hmm, right? For other people, it's like, oh my gosh, you know, everyone running around, jumping up. It's like that scene off Office. You ever seen The Office?
Oh, yeah.
You remember that scene when they had the fire drill and she threw a cat through the ceiling and came down?
Right. Yeah.
It's like that, right? Everybody goes nuts. But for us, we're like Dwight. We're like, hey, we know how fire started. How about we pull the fire alarm? How about we,
right?
So we're used to that. So what I'm saying, in other words, is that I'm a big believer in that nurture is very much stronger than nature itself.
Okay.
And the reason why I say that is because we have a natural nature. But if you put someone in a certain environment around their peers and their parents, you will start to see ideally what they are going toward. For example, you having a really close friend that was as smart as you are, I'm sure.
Right.
You both grew up in an environment where he became a close friend of yours and you both became teachers,
right?
So let's say that you got into the medical field and you chose, hey, I'm looking into biology. You meet another friend who also looked into biology. He decides he wants to become a dentist. Well, you being so close to him, realizing what he could possibly do, you believe you're capable of something similar. we really become part of our environment. Now, we can break free from our environment, but that becomes us individually thinking about the options and the possibility.
And a big chunk of that goes along with what you were saying, and that's this idea of how do we get our circumstances that we've been through, our emotional responses to those circumstances, and how do we find a way to like make those work together so that we can actually grow as a person. I had some terrible years when I was a kid. Terrible. I was constantly living in fear. Pain was just something that happened to me. Like, I carry it with me still because there's injuries that like never went to the doctor, so they never got healed, and they're with you for the rest of your life because that's what bones do. I could have just let that emotional experience just destroy me. And I know a lot of people who it does. I've got some really good friends who like, they're just physically incapable of the process of like getting out of their house for 40 hours a week, because that whole process of just getting out of bed in the morning takes them literally hours, right? Because what they experienced, they didn't have anybody else helping them out. They didn't have any support from other places. So they got crushed and there was nothing there to help them, right? And like, I can now relate to those people and help them out in other kinds of ways, but it's just my ability. This terrible stuff happened to me, gave me a perspective that allows me to go into much deeper, darker places than most people can like deal with, which as a dealing with teenagers, that's immensely helpful, because when they tell me things, this terrible thing is happening to me, all right, so what was it? Because like whatever it is that they're going to be telling me, it's either something that I've been through, something somebody I'm really close to has been through, or it's just teenagers being like, oh, this person doesn't like me. And it's like, okay, I can deal with that too. If I'd have been walking into this situation without that background, I probably would have gotten crushed in the first couple of years of school. What these kids are dealing with today and what they've been dealing with, it's terrible. And it's not just what's on the media, it's what's in their neighborhoods and what they're witnessing in their houses. For all the mistakes my parents made, I'm really glad that I had the ones that I did. I never questioned whether or not they loved me. I never had to worry about, are we gonna lose the house? I never had to like worry about all the necessities. They took care of that. They showed me I was loved. They encouraged me to become a better person. And that is what made the difference, right? Like, that's why it was I was able to take that horrible experience that I've been through and use it to help others. And a big part of that was learning there's an analytical side of what's happening. There's my own personal experience. Mm-hmm. There's my emotional state that I'm dealing with. And then there's the way other people perceive things. Those are all four separate realities, even if they're all wrapped up into one. And I was talking about this earlier. What my brain can do is I can separate all four of those out while experiencing them and have my brain running on, so what is the implications for all of this? That's where my critical thinking skills come from. So when people ask me like, how did you get so smart? I'm just like, I went through hell. Yeah. So you can't do what I did, but that doesn't mean you can't do equally amazing stuff in your own realm. Figure out what you're passionate about, what you want to do to make the world a better place. And for me, it's teaching. It's not for everybody. It's not attracting people with the pay scale, right? No. Like, you either do it because you love it or you get out of it pretty quickly.
Teachers are some of the most impactful people of raising the next generation on top of their parents, because everyone has a teacher that they can recall that made a difference in their life. And for me, I had several teachers. And one of the teachers that I can think of right now was my fourth and fifth grade teacher, Mr. Thomas, who really obsessed with reading. He would sit down and read books with us all the time, tell stories. And I still remember to this day him reading Holes, the book, and how the movie was exactly how he read it to us as the book. So I love that. So it allowed me to be creative and allow us to think, because I grew up out North Tulsa, single mother home, no dad around type environment. So for me, most of my imagination came from music. That's where a lot of it was. And some of it was cartoons and television. But that was a way to escape at least sometimes feeling lonely. And he did that just by telling stories to us. And he made us believe in ourselves. And he would have these very deep conversations with us that I don't think anybody comprehended at fourth or fifth grade. But looking back at it now, I don't remember everything he said, but I remember how he made me feel. Mm-hmm. It was something about it. He was so upset, but you can tell he cared. And then fast forward to several other teachers along the way. As a whole, all of it goes back to, if you're willing to learn, you're going to grow. And no matter what your circumstance, your environment is in, or where you're in, just know that you can adapt and you can survive. It just sucks right now. It sucks.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It sucks. But, you know, the thing about it is funny because whenever it's children, they're hurting and they're suffering when they're young, but they're so resilient. It's like they don't know what else to do but to feel it, but they get through it, right? And I think that that's something we can learn about children is they are very resilient and they're very smart and they're sponges, so they absorb information at a rate that's unimaginable to the average adult mind, right? So there's things to learn from our kids and children and ourselves as we teach children. Now, I personally teach adults, but I find it interesting when I do have teenagers in my classroom and seeing some of them being very well behaved, well disciplined, but you still see the energy and enthusiasm to learn. And I love that. I love seeing the enthusiasm in people that are adults, but definitely the fact that kids have it, we can still have that because we all have our inner child. And that's something special about that enthusiasm. And you have it in you. You have this passion that I just, his passion, his ability to speak and capture you is something that I wish every student has the option and the ability to have as a teacher. Because it just energizes you. Like, I didn't even look at anything on the script. Like, I stopped looking at the script at this point. Right. Just because it was just questions. But it just made me realize that you just have so much in your mind that is so important to other people to hear. And everyone has their specialty, and I think that's unique to say. Usually when you have a passion at something that you're good at, you're more likely to hit a wall a little bit faster. What I mean by that is that because you're so attuned into it, that whenever you go into a classroom setting for it, you already know it. But as you go and they start to test your abilities on it, they go, whoa, we got to give some more difficult stuff to this guy. And then as you go and go, you hit that wall. And all of a sudden, you're like, I'm not good anymore, right? You start to question how good you are. But the truth is, you were so good that you hit that wall a lot later than everyone else or faster. What I mean by later, meaning that you went further into the subject before you finally hit that wall. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and it reminds me of a story about Michael Jordan.
Of all people, right? Talking about how when he was in like eighth or ninth grade or something, his three-point shot sucked. So you're just like, he went out and was just like, so every day I just went out and shot threes until I got good at them.
Yep.
And I just like, but the problem was I was good at everything else. This is this one thing that I wasn't good at. I just had to work that much harder because that's the thing I wasn't good at.
Yes.
But I already mastered everything else, right? It's like when you go in, when you're studying high level mathematics, right? Like you get through all the stuff in high school and they're literally like, that's nice. That's nothing, right? Like our first day in honors chemistry, they went, so how many people learn, and they like start running down these lists of all these things of like people learn in high school and this list of like 25, 30 different laws you learn in chemistry class. All of those are wrong or only approximately true. And so then they'd go through and show us like, you know, PV equals NRT. Well, the actual equation is like P minus alpha times V plus or minus beta is equal to NRT plus whatever it is. And it's just like, so this nice simple thing that you used to think you knew, now you're coming up against the reality of it, which is way more complicated than you thought it was. Learn to enjoy the challenges in life.
As cliche as I've heard it through all the positive motivational podcasts, and you got to love the journey. You got to love the obstacles. Honestly, you kind of have to enjoy failure. I was thinking about it today on my way over here. You know, what's funny is that I remember thinking how when you fail or you literally fall, you're embarrassed. As you fall, continue to embarrass yourself. It's something that you're developing, that you're teaching yourself, I don't want to fall like that again. Kids, they fall often. They fall on their face, get up, they fall down, get up. And after a while, they're like, oh, if I move my leg, if I go too fast, I'm going to fall. So I need to learn how to balance myself before I just run. I got to walk a little bit. You know, a little bit at a time, one step, two step, oh, a little bit faster. What I'm learning is you have to be okay with embarrassing yourself. You have to be okay with failure because that's your opportunity to learn. So when Jordan was shooting those three shots and he could dunk the ball, he could cross you over, but he missed a three, that's embarrassing, right? But if you don't want to be embarrassed, work on what embarrasses you. If you're embarrassed by your math scores, you're embarrassed by your reading scores, work on it. But the tough part is, as a child, it's hard to know how to work on it. Nowadays, they literally can go to the computer and type in, how can I improve my reading? There's so many resources. And not only that, teachers have means of resources, meaning to show them to get online or use their phone, because obviously teachers don't get paid very much. There's ways that if they want to get better, they can, but they have to put the belief in them that they can. Because a lot of times we think what our reality is now is forever. Mm-hmm. And that's the biggest lie you could ever tell yourself. If you could summarize the philosophy or the ideology of your life in one sentence, theory of your life, the philosophy of your life into one sentence, and you are allowed to elaborate on it, but tell me what that is.
Because I remember thinking about this. I lost an ex student not too long ago to a car accident. And at the funeral, the only thing I could keep thinking was about how one of the first memories I had of this kid was they asked me in class, they're just like, "Oh, Paul, you're smart. What's the secret to happiness?" Right? And like, as I'm sitting there, I literally was just like in the middle of class. I'm just like, I'd been thinking about it a little bit, but it just came out. The secret to happiness is find something you love that makes the world a better place and do that, right? Beyond everything else, because we don't know about what's happening after we die. We don't know about reincarnation. All those are great ideas and they're nice things to make us feel better when we lose loved ones. But that's not changing the world now. Yes. And from my own perspective, with my own interpretation of like what the real message of Jesus was, it was to love making the world a better place. Yes. And if you can do that, happiness is going to follow, peace is going to follow, joy is going to follow, blessings are going to follow. Whether or not you're doing what you want in life, you are going to figure out what you need to do. And this kid took that and ran with it. And I got to see, like, 10 years after the fact that, like, what I had said to him, his little 14, 15-year-old head going like, "Whoa, that's crazy." Well, that's exactly what he did. With him, it was skateboarding. But he went and used skateboarding to reach out to people that nobody else would have, right? And gave them something to, like, worthwhile for their time.
There's a level of spirituality that ties into education anyways, right? And a lot of it is because of the fact that you're a teacher, and I'm very in tune with that concept myself too. Going back to that, like you said, there's an impactful idea of spirituality when it comes to after we pass away, a lot of it while we're still here, but there's a level of education that impacts everybody's world, period. Not that spirituality doesn't, but not everyone believes the same spirituality, right? But everybody knows there's a level of you have to learn, you have to listen. And hopefully you find your passion early enough to pursue it that you bring meaning into your life. There's a quote by Viktor Frankl, the book Man's Search for Meaning. And in that book, in the introduction aspect of it, it says, "Happiness cannot be pursued, it only ensues." That's such a powerful thing. It's almost like when someone's trying to be famous and they really want to be rich, they're just so aggressive about doing any and everything they can to achieve this broad idea of success. But when you find something you're good at and you love it, it will bring you success. Because you can only succeed, in my opinion, truly through empathy of others, loving what you do, and working aggressively and obsessively over that craft. And that's obviously what you did with math. And that's obviously what you did with teaching.
O'Shea, that's a perfect place to end. So I can't say it better myself. Thank you for having me on here.
Absolutely, man. Thank you. And thank you all for listening. Once again, it's O'Shea Davis with the Working Wonder Podcast Show. If I could have a group of people clap right now, I would. He needs a round of applause. But other than that, thank you again for tuning in. Please share, subscribe, and all the good stuff. And have a great day. And thank you again, Steve, for showing up. I appreciate you.